Hi, welcome everybody. My name's John Nichols, Chair for Session 5B, which is Living Logic, to be presented by Brendan Council and Rob DeSouza. So just start with a quick bio for each of our presenters and then get into the presentation. Brendan Council, Director in Ernst & Young's Financial Services Actuarial Practice based in Sydney. Has a broad range of experience in life insurance and wealth management consulting, covering clients based in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Hong Kong, and perhaps some others. He has extensive experience in LAGIC and ICAP through his involvement in capital implementation and review projects for a number of life insurance companies. He's currently a member of the Actuaries Institute Life Insurance and Wealth Management Practice Committee and International Accounting Standards Committee, in particular the latter covering the ISB's proposed IFRS for insurance contracts. Rob DeSouza is a partner of Ernst & Young, has worked in the financial services industry for 30 years in Australia, UK and South Africa, worked in a range of corporate and consulting roles over that period. More recently, he's held a number of appointed actuary roles and has been closely involved in the implementation and review of LAGIC standards for a number of clients. Rob has also been actively involved in the Actuaries Institute, most recently as the chair of the LAGIC Task Force, working closely with the industry and APRA. Pass over to Rob.
Good morning and welcome everybody. Today, we want to share some of our thoughts on the implementation of the LAGIC capital standards, having worked with a wide range of clients across the industry. During this work and this time, we've become aware that there's a wide range of practices or some range of practices across the industry, and we want to share that with you. As we go through the presentation, we're happy for people to raise questions and comments. But there will be some time at the end to discuss. So we will, as we work through, we'll share our observations and go through. The presentation is more focused on the capital requirements and the numbers and that side of it, and less on the ICAP. There have been other presentations on those. So we're just still staying to the numbers side a bit more this time. This is going to be a bit of a double act. Brendan and I are going to sort of be switching between each other. I like it to liken it to I'm Eric Morecambe to his Ernie Wise. Now, I can see you all looking, well, a couple of smiles there, but most of you are probably too young to know. Eric Morecambe and Wise were a very successful double act in the 70s and the 80s when I was growing up in British television. But for those of you in the know, the reason I'm doing this is because of his short, fat, hairy legs.
Well, I had to actually Google Morecambe and Wise to find out who they were, and I'm not ashamed to say that, Rob, because in my research I found out that they actually started in 1941, which was an incredibly long time ago. So I thought Flight of the Conchords would be a more contemporary double act, but you know, maybe you haven't heard of them, given your advanced age.
Well, moving on. I could talk about the cricket, but, you know, that's just not fair. I've got to push the button, sorry. So, you know, LAGIC is a journey. It's going to take time for the industry, the profession and APRA to fully understand the drivers of capital and how things are going to behave. It is apparent that companies are finding the standards are more complex than previously. And there have been issues on interpretation that we'll bring up, and on communication. For example, communicating for risk business, there's the insurance risk charge is zero is somewhat confusing. The combined stress scenario is a bit of a black box. Tax, how's that applied? Is there? So today, really, we're just going to work through this agenda. First, we're going to give an overview of how the pieces fit together. Many will know that, but I think it's going to be good background. Then we'll cover some of the observations on how capital's moved and why. We'll also look at the key areas that we've observed, the differing practices, which are sort of there, the stress margins, the combined stress scenario, the tax, which we've mentioned, and some of the other challenges. And finally, we're going to discuss areas of where people and companies can respond, some of them in terms of risk reduction and management of the and capital management. I thought the cartoon there was particularly relevant. I mean, I know to begin with, we felt we were in that sort of position. We were just plucking numbers out of the air, although things have sharpened up a bit since then.
Thanks, Rob. So I'm just going to give a bit of background to set the scene on key components of capital. So this slide shows an illustrative build-up for a typical life insurer and what the components are under the new LAGIC requirements. So none of this is particularly new, but the presentation under LAGIC has changed a bit. So I think it's useful just to have a look at this briefly first to set the scene for some of the topics that we're going to discuss a bit later on. The pie graph on the right there shows a standard build-up across the life company. We'll look at the different fund breakdowns in a moment, which shows there that most of the capital is taken up by the capital base adjustments, which is mostly the inadmissible deferred acquisition costs, with about 70% on average. And then the prescribed capital amount, the PCA, or the risk capital, taking up about 30% of the overall capital requirement. And it's interesting, just on the pie chart on the left side, we did a survey a couple of months ago on ICAPS, actually, but one of the questions was just around internal models and whether companies had any intention or were considering using internal models for life company regulatory capital. And the answer was a resounding no, and in most cases the reason was just because of this, where you've only really got 30% roughly of your capital to play with on an internal model for a typical life company. The pie chart on the right there shows the components of the 30% prescribed capital amount, and again, it's illustrative, but basically asset risk charge makes up about half of it. Then you've got insurance risk and operational risk, about half again. There's an aggregation benefit, and it's a bit difficult to show on this chart, but that gives a benefit between the insurance and the asset risk charge. And then finally, the combined scenario, stress scenario adjustment, which we will talk about a bit later on, there doesn't really appear to be a typical amount for that. We've seen quite a wide range there, from zero to about half of the unadjusted prescribed capital amount. This one just goes into a bit more detail on individual funds and focuses on the prescribed capital amount only. Again, nothing really new here. I don't think there's any particular surprises. So a statutory fund that had only participating business is mostly made up of asset risk. Then risk business, we've got, again, unsurprisingly, a big chunk of insurance risk with a smaller block of asset risk, and funds with risk in par tend to be a mix of the two. The shareholder fund, again, we've got concentration limits now in the shareholder fund, and this is, it's not that typical. It's hard to put a typical shareholder fund breakdown up there, but we've just brought out the concentration risk there, but it's very specific to individual companies and what assets they have in their shareholder fund. And finally, investment linked, obviously mostly operational risk, but there is some asset risk there now that we're including that on assets, not backing the policy liabilities. This slide summarises implications for life companies. So what we've seen broadly, looking at the change in the amount of capital, regulatory capital held compared with the previous standards. So overall, with a couple of notable exceptions, the capital positions generally either unchanged or reduced from the previous standards. Obviously, there's some exceptions to that. And then the two slides here try to split that down to different types of products. So generally, where companies have seen increases in their funds, participating business and capital guaranteed. So in particular, we've noted that the combined stress scenario charges can be quite adverse. Actually, the guarantee is much more likely to bite under those scenarios. Annuity business, so lower risk-free rates generally now on annuity business, increasing the capital there. Funds with a narrower range of products or companies with a narrower range of products generally mean there's less allowances for diversification, so less diversification between asset and insurance risk within the asset risk charge, within the insurance risk charge, and so on. Companies that have seen products with reductions in capital, risk business with good profitability generally tends to have lower capital requirements than under the previous standards, just due to the allowance for stressed cash flows over the first year now. So if those cash flows are still positive, then that can provide a bit of an offset. Note, though, that there is a new operational risk requirement for risk business that's diminishing this somewhat, but generally it's still coming down overall. Generally, funds with a wide range of products tend to do better because there's diversification benefits between the products within the fund. So it's very much dependent on the mix of business and the relative profitabilities, in particular now that all non-participating business is grouped together in determining the adjusted policy liabilities and the insurance stresses. That's your slide, Brett.
Thanks. On stress margins, this is just going to be a quick overview. There's actually a whole presentation next by Martin and Bree Allen going into a bit more detail on the stress margins. But we thought we'd share what we've seen across the industry as well. There's been a lot of borrowing from the Risk Business Capital Task Force and their original paper a few years back in terms of methodologies used, as well as some sort of borrowing from the APRA numbers that were provided for the quizzes. So if we first of all just go through to the sort of misestimation part of the first part, then that tends to have been fairly consistent across the industry, and most companies have sort of used the approach discussed in the Risk-Based Capital Task Force paper. Remembering that paper actually was developed as a discussion paper and not actually as a methodology to sort of become sort of widely adopted. So it's sort of a starting point. But as I say, many have used that sort of approach here in terms of the sort of setting the misestimations of the mean. In terms of trend risk, the Risk-Based Capital Task Force paper has been used as a base for many. Some have done it without many adjustments. Some have actually sort of started there and then made small adjustments to the approach, splitting down margins, applying different margins to things like the RF Bell, the risk-free Bell, and the IBNR, and sort of starting to take it on a little bit further. However, some companies have actually done a bottom-up sort of calculation of the margins and sort of then sort of put them together, allowing for diversification across the product. So we are seeing quite a divergence in this sort of area, which isn't too surprising because it's sort of fairly new area, and trying to work out trend risk is sort of quite requires quite a lot of judgment as well. For the RF Bell and sort of looking at the termination values, this really is sort of which margins carry most weight, you know, which ones have the biggest impact. And we're sort of seeing that where they do have the impact is really where the termination values have come into play. It's things like the CICP, so any margins applied to that are important. IBNRs more so, and tends to be group risk as well, again, where the accumulation methodology has sort of come into play and not quite so allowance for future profits, although there are second order impacts that sort of flow through, so there are benefits there. In terms of random stress margins, so within the other margins, there's simulation methodologies have been used, and they tend to be similar, a bit of difference in sophistication and sort of number of simulations performed. Some have up to sort of 50,000, some much smaller. But generally, random margins have much smaller impact because they're only really applying for the first year, and although there isn't, we have seen exceptions, but generally it's sort of not such an important part of the margins being included. Then we have the event margins. So there, the APRA-specific minimum scenario is usually used, and it's supported by comparing the pandemic stress severity with the catastrophic event affecting the company's insurance concentration. So you sort of there is some sort of testing back testing of that. And then lapse margins, that really is where most of judgments has been applied. Some companies have used the sort of quiz 2 50%. Some have used the sort of Solvency II type levels, and others have even gone back to sort of previous ranges from CAPAD. So there's again a sort of bit of a range there. One of the questions that comes to my mind is whether we want more consistency there and whether we should be seeking guidance possibly from the Institute to start sort of setting out the things, or even from APRA. So that really, if I flick to the next page, sort of gives you a feel. The coloured parts are the ranges between the second and third quartiles, and the whiskers are the first and fourth quartiles. So it does show that, you know, whilst there sort of tend to be some grouping, some of them, e.g. Group TPD, has a very wide range, and there are some outliers in terms of margin set. So that sort of gives you a bit of a feel there of sort of what we're seeing. And we... I should say we've actually worked with most of the larger direct writers, larger and medium-sized ones. So that sort of gives a feel from there rather than including the whole industry there.
Cool.
Yeah?
That chart suggests that people would be... Oh, sorry, that's too far away. I'll just speak that way. The chart suggests that some people think the retail IP incidence margin is lower than the retail death margin. Is that right?
Well, So in terms of the actual numbers, or do you think are you talking about
the retail IP incidence, first quartiles, yes. I don't know, 5 or 7% or something, the retail deaths above 10% by looks at it.
That's correct. There is a...
Okay.
So we've picked out a few things on methodology and interpretation that we've seen companies focusing on, spending a fair bit of time on, in some cases struggling a bit with. There's probably plenty more and welcome discussion at the end. The couple that I've pulled out, and in particular the combined stress scenario adjustment and tax, and there's a few others that we'll discuss on the final slide. So the combined stress scenario adjustment, it's probably just worth recapping the history of this briefly, just to set the context a bit. So during the standards development, tax and management actions became problematic. So in response to stresses, became problematic because the way that the new standards are now set up is that there are a lot of different stresses and then correlation matrices, etc., applied over the top. So previously it wasn't that complex. And so I think in the first quiz there are a lot of companies struggling with that. And in particular, how do you apply tax and management actions to the stress scenarios, but without taking too much credit, because there is a number of different scenarios. So, for example, making sure that you don't double count tax assets and the like. So in quiz two, the APRA proposed a the combined stress scenario adjustment. I can't remember if it was actually called that at the time, as an alternate way to calculate this. It wasn't required. It was just a suggestion at that time, and they said, you know, do what you want to do, but make sure you can support it, etc. So some companies did that, others didn't, and then in the final standard, the final draft standards, which were issued in late 2011, this became a requirement. So effectively, the piece of quiz two was taken out of the technical paper and put into one of the standards. As a result, that change had a substantial impact for some companies that had not thought about it that way before. So there was a bit of a flurry sort of in early 2012 between when the draft standards and the final standards came out in May, with companies trying to understand what this thing is and how do we calculate it. The way that the standards have written the second point there about the second order impacts, so the way the standards are written is that you calculate diversification factors through another process. We'll talk about that a little bit in a minute, and apply those factors directly to the stress margins. And what some companies have noticed is that can actually result in second order impacts that don't relate to necessarily tax or management actions. So question was really whether that was the original intention from APRA when they put this into the standards. So that was probably the key point on interpretation, which a number of companies were grappling with. It's also more complex now, it's added additional runtime to the calculations. So the capital build-up has become this sort of stepwise approach. There's a number of runs that you need to do in your calculation valuation models to calculate diversification factors, which then feed into the next lot and so on and so forth. And I think if you actually do it from where to go, there's probably about 15 different calculations to go through, and you can't run them all at once because of this stepwise approach with this combined stress scenario applying at the end. So that was the third point. Then the final point there is just the communication aspects. So that has been a little bit difficult. Some companies have noticed to communicate up to management. So it's nice and easy if you carve out the risks, insurance risk, asset concentration risk, etc., and say, well, we're holding this much capital for this risk, this much capital for another risk. This thing is a full stress to the balance sheet, and it's not as easy to communicate to senior management and boards, etc., in the same way as if you break it down into the risks. The other one is tax, always an issue. So we've observed some companies spending significant amounts of time on this. So the standards make reference to relevant tax legislation. And for life insurers, unfortunately, that legislation is pretty complex. And what we've observed is varying levels of precision used to reflect the complexity of that tax legislation in the capital calculations. So at one end, some companies applying a broad brush approach with not a lot of focus on particular nuances of the tax legislation. At the other end, Companies are looking at all assets and liabilities, making allowance for different types of business, tax pools, income versus capital gains, VPST, SEA transfers, and so on and so forth. So that is another area for those companies that has led to a great deal of complexity in the calculations. And across the industry, we've seen, as a result, variance of different practices to DTA, deferred tax asset recoverability, and in some cases, some fairly large capital impacts. Finally, this was just probably a summary of other issues to mention. So implementation issues, we've touched on some of those already. So the complexity of calculations, I think a lot of companies are calling that one out. And in particular, this stepwise approach to the build-up of the capital and the resource constraints that entails. So for a company that's got a wide range of business products and a number of different statutory funds going through whatever it is, six runs in the insurance risk charge, then another six in the asset risk charge, and then a couple of combined scenario, it can soak up a lot of resource and a lot of time. So getting that through monthly processes, quarterly processes, that sort of thing is really, really putting a strain on resources. Understanding of the drivers of capital now. So previously we all had our rules of thumb and we've been doing CAPAD and solvency calcs for a number of years. Now I think there's a bit of work to be done to really understand the capital, the movements in the capital over time, so that will come out with time, but also because I think a lot of companies got this thing over the line late last year and didn't really have a lot of time to assess the sensitivities to various parameters, so on and so forth. So there's probably a bit of work to do there. Application of judgment. So probably a fairly obvious one. So less room for judgment and appointed actuary discretion in these standards than there was under the previous ones. So we've seen instances where something not prescribed in the regulatory capital standards is included in target surplus, for example. Other issues, we've touched on communication to management. So examples there, the combined stress scenario, what does that all mean? So that's one. We've seen a number of instances where life insurers, because of their particular product mix, will have a insurance risk charge of zero. And how do you explain that, the reason for that, to someone in senior management? Well, we're an insurance company, but we don't have any insurance risk. That has been challenging. Companies have been spending a bit of time reevaluating target surplus policies. So this thing doesn't move in the same way as the old capital standards did. So there's some work to be done there. Capital appears to be more sensitive to market movements than under the old standards, from what I've seen. But interested in views on that from anyone who's been close to it. And also, there's a few areas in the detail where discontinuities can occur. So a small change in a parameter can lead to a large change in capital. And examples I'm thinking of there is, you know, if you did have an insurance risk charge of zero and suddenly it was pushed significantly above zero, or the other one is where the asset risk charge scenarios can flip over time. That was sort of a summary of the interpretive issues. And Rob.
Okay. Yeah, before covering off the last slide here, I just wanted to go back to Mark's question. The retail IP is that's just the incident rate, and so to give a bit more sort of clarity, because the margins are put on the incident rate and the termination rates, that the organisation had a heavier loading up on the terminations, so therefore in total the margins are greater, but not at that sort of level, suddenly realised. So what does this mean, really? What are the key focus areas? How are people responding and changing as a result of these new standards? So risk management and risk reduction, I should say, and capital management have actually need to be reassessed. You know, the rules have changed. And you know, ICAAP has brought this more into focus as well. So we're sort of seeing the boards and management, because they're signing off and taking responsibility, actually putting more focus again on the structures, on the risks that are being taken, on whether or not risk can be reduced and therefore capital reduced as well. So it's there. We're also sort of seeing, we did a survey, and most people called out. Which we referred to, sorry, in the yesterday, it was part of the ICAAP survey, but this part came out about what sort of focus areas to date in terms of the capital side and the numbers. And asset allocation and reinsurance have been key focus areas, although reinsurance is more so on the general insurance side, but it is still something that can be utilised on the life insurance side as well. So asset allocation, it's fair to say that companies have picked the low-hanging fruit, you know, for example, removing large asset concentrations and dealing with assets that lead to higher charges. But there are possible next steps. You can go down to the sort of next level of and looking at whether the diversification benefits can be changed through asset allocations. Look at matching. You know, most people have matching annuity books, but risk books, there's different ways of matching, whether it's to reduce profit volatility or capital, so you can re-look there from the point of view of capital, and even par books, looking at the structure and matching there can be followed. Reinsurance, there is an opportunity to transfer risk and hence reduce capital, but no careful consideration is required here so that it doesn't get structured so that it is financial reinsurance. I don't think financial reinsurance is something that is a viable option in our environment. Business mix. We're finding that you can get a bit of a sweet spot depending on your mix of business. Even retail risk and group risk can be balanced to get a... an improvement in capital in terms of where it was on the previous standards. So there is an opportunity. It's possible to manage that mix. That could be done in terms of the capital allocation, which is sort of lower down, you know, loading up products where you think are more risky, or because in particular, when I say loading up, I mean it's more about the allocation of the diversification benefits. You know, those arise across the business. If you've got a particular wish to grow one line more than another, then you can change use that allocation process to help manage the mix. There is also sort of, although more difficult, you could actually control your mix to a degree as well. But there are, you know, stronger focus now on the capital implications of the different mixes of business. Entity restructuring. One of the things that was talked about is merging stat funds. There's also tax funding agreements and how they're structured to provide benefits. Stat funds probably aren't as big an issue as originally thought. There are diversification benefits that can be achieved or offsets anyway. And then finally, repricing. Not anything we've seen at this point, but you know, with the new capital allocations, that may mean that products are going to be priced more heavily and other ones less heavily compared to where they are at the moment to get the required return on capital. So nothing major there yet, but we are seeing some sort of considerations around that, particularly in the group market. So that's really where we are today. That's the end of our presentation at this point. We now would like to open it up to everybody to ask questions.
Just a reminder, with the questions, please come up to the microphone and state your name.
Bruce Vincent. First, thanks for your great presentation, you and your little friend. Just wanted to touch on a practical point about the calculations. So I think we all understand there's a lot of detail, a lot of iteration. How often, this is probably an open question really, how often do companies do full calculations? What approximations are possible or plausible or acceptable for quarterly returns, and what do companies do, what should they do monthly? So, sorry, more questions than actual answers there.
I'll start by answering that from what I'm seeing. And that's basically that people are reticent at this point to make too many approximations. They're unsure as to the sort of impacts and sensitivities. Although sensitivity runs have been done, we are seeing that the new standards are probably more sensitive to market movements. It obviously depends a bit on your mix of business as well. And so many are actually doing sort of full runs, full recalculating diversification benefits. I know APRA a while back suggested that you only needed to set once and once a year or something like that and use the same rate. But we are seeing that at this stage people are reticent to flow that through. I don't know whether it's quite a broad statement there, and whether anybody else has got a contrary view or just another view.
Yeah, I mean, I've probably seen three approaches. One is work really hard and do the whole thing, which tends to result in a lot of people spending a lot of time in the office late at night. The second is roll forward approaches. So I've seen probably a few companies doing a full calculation and then rolling it forward for a month to save that time. And I have seen one or two set their diversification factors, so it's probably not, as Rob says, companies still wanting to understand the movements more before taking that approach. But that is another one that one or two have done, which is to set your diversification factors and cut out all of that calculation and just do one or two runs more regularly.
Martin Considine from Challenger. Thanks for the presentation, guys. Follow on a bit to the last question. For the ICAAP report, we've got to do 3 years' worth of capital forecasts. I think it's pretty clear that the actual capital calculations in a hard close are not simple. Over a three-year period, how do you feel the industry is prepared to do those calculations to some level of accuracy, in particular one that would be signed off by the board as accurate and the CEO as accurate?
It's a good question, and I suppose my response at this point would be that most companies are doing forward projections at a fairly high level, and in particular using sort of factor-based approaches until they develop something a bit more substantial. So I think that's going to be a real challenge as companies come up to preparing ICAAP reports, because, I know the standards do imply a certain level of accuracy in those, a certain level of granularity in the forward projections.
Yeah, particularly the question of the boards. We're seeing a number of boards grappling over materially accurate. I think that's the phrase. I can't remember exactly. And the level of due diligence and the level of accuracy that you need to put in the process. So, we're sort of at the early stages with that, but it's sort of the question really is what is appropriate, because I think it's for the board to call what is materially accurate. It has been sort of left a little open. What's appropriate in terms of, you know, does it make a material difference to the decision-making process? If you were sort of have an approximation in there, then if it doesn't, then it allows you room to sort of move in that sort of, as I say, an approximate type of method. But I think it comes down to each individual board to a degree as to what they're comfortable with. And I think, you know, this is something that will develop over the next year. So.
Chris Johnson. Just coming back to Bruce's question about how often you need to do the calculations. Once you've done the calculations once and you can understand what drives the ultimate result, you can take some shortcuts. For instance, for risk business, the RF bell often doesn't dominate, the termination value does dominate, so you don't actually have to rerun all your different runs for risk business with all your risk margins to calculate your RF bell. You can just use the termination value, and that saves you some time and effort. I think that probably happens for most companies, but of course you don't realise that until you've done it for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, you do need the risk-free bell to calculate the diversification factors. So, again, it depends whether you're happy to set those diversification factors recalculate them on over a longer period. Or whether, and I think this is the hesitation for some companies at the moment is they don't know how big an impact those factors have on their actual overall capital. So, you know, in theory they're a bit second order, but companies haven't done enough calculations yet to fully understand that. So. I think that's right. That's where the industry will probably head. But for the time being, I think companies are just trying to understand the sensitivity to these different factors.
John Oakley, thanks. Echo what other people have said. Great presentation, very thought-provoking. I just wanted to ask, in terms of some of the focus areas, you touched on the fact that business mix, you know, you can hit a sweet spot, and repricing of products being an area of focus. So my question is about that, in terms of, have you sort of seen or any sense on how companies might deal with the way to allocate capital to their products for the purposes of pricing, given that there may be diversification across a range of products within a statutory fund, and how they might be sort of dealing with that in terms of allocating it back to products or business lines for pricing?
Yeah, the interesting question, and some of this is sort of proprietary information, so I can't really go too far. But what I would say is that some are thinking about their allocations and changing them from where they are, where they were, or the approach used prior to Logic. Others are not so as far advanced, and maybe that's a deliberate decision not to make changes. So you've got an allocation process in there, and as I say, some of them are sort of really moving that forward quite quickly. That then flows through. I mean, in the group business in particular, it's being repriced every time a tender comes up. So if the allocations have changed, or even if they haven't changed, that will have a sort of flow-through process. Other organisations are also looking at repricing, given that there are other issues. If you've changed the allocation, then that will, I would use the word slip through, but maybe it's not slip, it's more, but it will flow through into the calculations, and allowing for sort of the sort of move in capital allocation if that's been done. The capital has changed, and it's really, you know, the process of working out how to allocate the diversification benefit is probably the most the area of greatest judgment.
Okay. Time for a couple more questions.
might ask one question. You sort of indicate, obviously, the standards are becoming more risk-sensitive. That said, still 70% is driven by the DAC asset. Would you see a change in the need for companies to look at other capital measures, for example, economic capital, to get a better picture of the true risk?
Yeah. Yes, certainly. There's probably a number of companies that are already looking at... they run economic capital models fairly regularly, I think, to give them that picture of the true risk. In those models, they would make their assumptions about that DAC asset, obviously. Yes, certainly. There's a lot of scope there, I think. My point when I put that slide up really was that there's probably not a lot of appetite for using economic capital or internal models to get APRA approval to determine the regulatory capital for that reason, the DAC asset.
Yeah. So while the DAC asset is substantial, there's still a significant proportion due to sort of other elements.
One last burning question? If not, please thanks Rob and Brendan for a very great presentation.